Welcome everyone to the first of the sleep network for chest, the respiratory sleep sections webinars. Today we have Dr. Kar Dupuy McCauley, who will be speaking to us about central sleep apnea. Dr. McCauley has her bachelor's in music and technology from University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She then did her internal medicine residency in the Beaumont Hospital, and then completed her pulmonary as well as her sleep medicine fellowships at the Mayo. She's currently faculty there and is an invited speaker at CHEST, ATS, and sleep conferences. And I most recently heard her speak about central sleep apnea in Hawaii and in CHEST. It was a fabulous talk. Welcome, Dr. Dupuy McCauley.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be doing this today. This is the first of hopefully many webinars from the Sleep Network here. So today, I'm going to talk about central sleep apnea, including the pathophysiology and treatment. It's one of my favorite things to talk about. I'm Kara Dupuy. I'm from Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And I do have a disclosure to make. I do some work for Respicardia, who are the makers of the Remedy system, which is the phrenic nerve stimulator for treatment of central sleep apnea. Actually, I'm going to be talking about that today. So just keep in mind that they have paid me money before. So today we're going to be talking about the group of disorders that is central sleep apnea, and talking about the pathophysiology of all of the different types of central sleep apnea, and then using that knowledge to discuss what treatment options are available and which treatment options make sense for which types of central apnea. So the definition of a central apnea is a period where you have a absence of airflow and absence of effort. And so on your sleep study, you'll see no airflow here and no effort here. And then the syndrome of central sleep apnea is if you have this happening repetitively over 5 times an hour with symptoms. We have a little bit of data about the epidemiology. A lot of this comes from the Sleep Heart Health study. When you look at patients who are presenting to the sleep lab, it's about 1%, and then about half of those are going to be people with Cheyne-Stokes breathing. And in this data set, people were more likely to be men who are older with a lower BMI and a lower upper sleepiness scale than their OSA counterparts. Important to note, though, in this study, that suggested that obstructive sleep apnea was a lot more common than central sleep apnea. But if you look at other studies looking at patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, the actual incidence in that population is likely a lot higher. 25 to 50% are the figures most often. In the Sleep Heart Health study, it was self-reported heart failure. So that's probably why that was lower. But anyway, just a point of interest in patients with heart failure. This actually happens a lot. The risk factors for central apnea are age. So probably due to increasing comorbidity as people age, but could be due to the aging process itself. More common in men, heart failure, atrial fibrillation, valvular disease, stroke. It can occur in the acute setting, and it can actually occur long-term too, depending on the location of the stroke. And then renal failure, medications, most commonly opioids, but there's also a couple other ones that we'll talk about. And then there's kind of an other category. So conditions, including spinal cord injury, acromegaly, and neuromuscular disease. There is primary central sleep apnea, also known as idiopathic central sleep apnea. And that is where we don't have another reason for the presence of central sleep apnea. And then there are many different causes of secondary central sleep apnea. So this illustrates why central sleep apnea is not really one thing. It's a group of disorders. And this is why treatment can be challenging, because the central sleep apnea is sometimes occurring for very different reasons, patient to patient. And so there's no one size fits all approach that's going to work for everyone. So when you have secondary sleep apnea, that can come from Cheyne-Stokes breathing or people with heart failure, central sleep apnea due to high altitude periodic breathing, treatment emergent central sleep apnea that comes about when people with OSA are in the sleep lab and we put PAP on them and we discover central sleep apnea. Central sleep apnea due to a medical disorder without Cheyne-Stokes. So this will be, you know, if you have a stroke and central sleep apnea as a result of that, and it catches kind of all of those different medical disorders. And then central sleep apnea due to a medication or substance. And these are from the ICSD-3. So, you know, this is how we code all of these different sleep-related breathing disorders. I read this really wonderful paper by Ashok Javahari and Safwan Batter, which describes central sleep apnea based on the etiology. And after I read that paper, I reorganized this talk because I think it makes so much sense to categorize things according to their etiology and then, you know, using that structure to think about how you would treat each of these types of patients. So we have high loop gain, which is the primary or idiopathic central sleep apnea, Cheyne-Stokes, high altitude periodic breathing, and treatment emergent central sleep apnea, failure of rhythmogenesis, which is typically going to happen due to medications or some sort of structural incident affecting the breathing centers. And then other. So Cheyne-Stokes, or I'm sorry, central sleep apnea due to a medical disorder without Cheyne-Stokes. And the others are typically going to fall into one of two categories, either high loop gain with high plant gain. So conditions associated with chronic hypercapnia and spinal cord injury, and then pseudo-central sleep apnea. I like the term pseudo-central sleep apnea because in this type of central sleep apnea, the brain actually is sending a signal to breathe most of the time. It's just that because of neuromuscular weakness or some sort of restriction in the thoracic cage, you know, there's no respiratory movement happening. So it will still look the same on a polysomnogram, where you'll see, you know, no airflow and no effort, but the reason why it's happening is a little bit different than some of the other types of central apnea. The clinical presentation of central sleep apnea, you know, a lot of times we compare it to obstructive apnea and say that, you know, typically these patients are less sleepy, you know, and have less report of disordered breathing by the bed partner, which can be true, but I think it's important when you're talking about the patient population that has central sleep apnea and their clinical presentations, it can really be all over the board. So they can still have symptoms of sleep fragmentation and excessive daytime sleepiness. And then they can also have, you know, shortness of breath at night. I talked to a lot of people who will awaken during the hyperpneic phase. You know, so they just had a breathing pause and they awaken taking, you know, some deep breaths. Some people awaken because they're short of breath. So there's a spectrum there. And then as opposed to obstructive sleep apnea, where you have, you know, loud snoring, breathing pause, loud snoring, a lot of times the bed partner will say, oh, they're actually really quiet when they sleep. Or I have a lot of people say, yeah, sometimes I have to reach over and poke them to see if they're still breathing. So, you know, it's not necessarily breathing pauses. And sometimes I just ask, you know, have you noticed any abnormal breathing in your bed partner? Because it can be, like I said, a little bit different than the description of obstructive apnea. For diagnosis, polysomnogram is the gold standard, as always. Home sleep apnea testing can detect central sleep apnea. Even the WatchPat claims to have a good sensitivity and specificity, but I think we are maybe quite there getting a really, really good accurate diagnosis of central sleep apnea in the home environment. But then the other reason that it's really helpful to have a polysomnogram is for the titration portion of it. As I mentioned, there's all sorts of different reasons that people have central sleep apnea. And so one treatment that might work really well for one person won't work for another person. And also insurance in many cases won't cover the treatment for central sleep apnea unless you prove that in the sleep lab. So still the best way to do this is with a polysomnogram to take advantage of the titration opportunity and of course for insurance reimbursement, which unfortunately we do have to think about. All right, so now I'm going to talk about some more details about the different types of the pathogenesis of central sleep apnea. So Kailupine is a term from the electronics world, which describes how multiple inputs to a system affect the output. In this case, the output is homeostasis, respiratory homeostasis, maintenance of pH and carbon dioxide and oxygen levels. And then the inputs to that system that we're going to be describing here are inputs from the heart, the brain, and the lungs. So we have controller gain, which is chemoresponsiveness, and that relates to the peripheral and central chemoreceptors. And then plant gain, which relates to the lungs, and some of this is stretch receptor activation, and some of it is change in carbon dioxide level over change in alveolar volume, and then the mixing time, or the blood circulation time. And so if any of these elements get out of balance, then it can lead to a high loop gain system and predispose the patient for central sleep apnea. And what happens during the respiratory cycle might look something like this, where, you know, you have your CO2 somewhere above your apneic threshold. There's some sort of respiratory stimulus that happens. Oftentimes this will have something to do with the carbon dioxide, but can also be oxygen. And the patient will have a period of hyperpnea where they breathe a lot, which will cause the carbon dioxide to go below the apneic threshold, and then you will have a breathing pause. And then during that breathing pause, carbon dioxide is going to rise again, and you know, whatever stimulus that kicked off the whole thing is usually going to come back into the picture, and then you're going to have another period of hyperpnea and another breathing pause. And so most of the time in central sleep apnea, we see pretty high AHI levels, because once you get into this dysfunctional breathing cycle, it's hard to break out of that. So for idiopathic or primary central sleep apnea, this is the diagnosis of exclusion. So you really have to rule out all of the other causes of central sleep apnea. It is prevalent in 4 to 7% of central sleep apnea patients referred to sleep medicine. So it's less common to have idiopathic central sleep apnea. And that's why it's important to do a little bit of a directed workup in this patient population. There's actually a study that suggested 27% of people with quote-unquote idiopathic central sleep apnea may have atrial fibrillation. So I think it's important to at least do an echocardiogram if the patient has and not had one recently, because of the high incidence of heart failure in this population. And then, you know, at least an EKG, a good physical exam. And I usually question patients about any symptoms of, you know, intermittent shortness of breath, palpitations, things like that. And if appropriate, I've actually even ordered a Holter monitor in the past if there's a high index of suspicion. Obviously, that would just be based on your clinical judgment, though. In Cheyne-Stokes respiration, you have to have an AHI of at least 5, with over half of the events being central in nature. They have to have symptoms, and the respiratory cycle length has to be at least 40 seconds. So these are criteria from the ICSD-3. And this is, you know, one of the main ones. Although I will say, if you see this on a sleep study, it's usually pretty easy to recognize. But this is the technical specification and sometimes what differentiates it from other types of sleep, of central sleep apnea. With Cheyne-Stokes, you'll have increased chemosensitivity and increased mixing gain. So increased time that the blood takes to circulate through the body. It's higher risk in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, as you might imagine, but you can also see it in high heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. Although I will say that I don't think that I have seen this very often in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. I don't know if anyone else has another experience with that. It can be exacerbated by pulmonary edema, increasing the pulmonary capillary pressure, which, as I mentioned, can increase loop gain, and then that would stimulate respiration or hyperpnea. And it's associated with a poorer prognosis. And so classically, you'll see this waxing and waning crescendo, decrescendo pattern in your respiratory airflow signal. The next one is high altitude periodic breathing. This is a picture of me and my friend when we were in Wyoming. This is probably at about 9,000 feet. Everyone was starting to experience symptoms, and we were not smart this day. And as soon as we ascended to altitude, decided to go mountain biking up the mountain. It was not the smartest thing I've ever done. I'll be including this picture in my talk about high altitude pulmonary edema. I'm just kidding. So over 3,000 meters, almost everyone develops high altitude periodic breathing, but the presence and severity can vary. This is caused by increased controller gain in response to a hypoxic environment and increase in carbon dioxide response. So this one is actually usually triggered by hypoxia instead of carbon dioxide. And so that's why oxygen works well for treatment. This will usually manifest as a cluster pattern with several breaths and then followed by an apnea. So typically you will not see that waxing and waning pattern. And typically it will have a shorter cycle duration than Shane Stokes. But patients will usually describe similar symptoms, disrupted sleep, sometimes waking up with either dyspnea or hyperapnea. Treatment emergent central sleep apnea is the next one in this category. The incidence is about 12% on average, but it varies depending on what study you look at. So it's been reported between 2 and 20% based on the type of study that was performed and whether it was split night versus full titration. And the risk factors for treatment emergent central sleep apnea do overlap with risk factors for central sleep apnea in general. So male gender, if the patient has underlying severe obstructive sleep apnea, they're more likely to have this. If they have really high pressures on CPAP, and then of course, if they have any of these other conditions that predisposes to central sleep apnea. It's important to note also, treatment emergent central sleep apnea does not just happen in PAP therapy. There is some data in the literature about a variety of other treatments for obstructive apnea in which treatment emergent central sleep apnea has been reported, including mandibular advancement devices, hypoglossal nerve stimulation. I did find a prevalence report of 3%. The tongue protrusion device, I don't know a lot of people who use that because I've heard they're very uncomfortable. Provent nasal EPAP. This is not on the market anymore, but there are other nasal EPAP devices, so I would presume that it would be, you know, similar risk. Tracheostomy, maxillofacial surgery, although relatively uncommon, and then soft tissue surgery. And some of these don't have incidence reports in the literature. So the next category we have, failure of rhythmogenesis. The rhythm of breathing originates in the pre-Botzinger complex in the ventrolateral medulla. So as I mentioned before, if you have anything that is affecting that area, you can get alterations in breathing pattern. The most common in this category is going to be opioids, but there's case reports of other medications, including baclofen, valproic acid, and sodium oxybate, and a few others. And actually, I just recently had a patient who was on tizanidine, who I really think that was a cause of his central sleep apnea. I'm going to write that up with one of our fellows. So this probably comes from a depression of the inspiratory neurons in the pre-Botzinger complex. That area has opioid and GABA receptors. And you can see a variety of different respiratory patterns, but the classic one would be ataxic breathing. And that's where you have a very irregular breathing rhythm and also irregular amplitudes of each breath. One point of interest, ticagrelor, which is a platelet inhibitor, causes moderate to severe central sleep apnea in 30% of patients, which I think is strikingly high. I'm still waiting for that sleep medicine referral where someone comes in and they're on ticagrelor and I can look really smart by telling everyone that the ticagrelor is causing central sleep apnea, but that hasn't happened for me yet. So structural reasons for central sleep apnea can be in the form of Chiari malformation, which can compress the medulla and alter respiratory mechanics and chemoreceptor function. Stroke, depending on which area the stroke is in, it can impair ventilation in different ways during sleep. I actually have seen this. I had a patient who had a stroke in the pons and he had permanent central sleep apnea after that. And then of course, tumors, if they're compressing the breathing centers, and also a neurodegenerative disease. So as that progresses, you can get impairment in the respiratory centers as well. And then the other category. So high loop gain and high plant gain is one of these. So this can happen in conditions associated with chronic hypercapnia and sometimes in spinal cord injury as well. And part of the reason for this, is the location of the patient's baseline carbon dioxide level on this carbon dioxide curve. So, you know, normally the carbon dioxide level should be down here in a flatter portion of the curve. If the patient has an elevated carbon dioxide at baseline, then small changes in ventilation can really cause, you know, large shifts in carbon dioxide level and sometimes shift that below the apneic threshold. And then pseudo-CSA, as I mentioned, can be due to neuromuscular weakness or severe thoracic cage abnormality. This is the opening slide that I used. So this is actually from a patient who, when I saw him, he had not been diagnosed with anything. He had just some kind of nonspecific neuromuscular symptoms and a very abnormal overnight oximetry. And so when we did his study, you could see having paradox in the thorax and the abdominal bands, suggesting obstruction, or in this case, diaphragmatic dysfunction. And then, you know, this period where there's no airflow and then no respiratory effort. And then this is the hypnagram from his polysomnogram. And I thought this was really interesting because on his oximetry, we were just seeing these, you know, periodic episodes of oscillatory variability and decline in the baseline oxygen saturation, which really looked like it could be, you know, obstructive apnea and hypoventilation during REM. But then when we did the sleep study, we realized that, you know, when he lost the function of the diaphragm, that was really when all this central sleep apnea started occurring in REM sleep. So this one you have to look out for, because classically we think that central sleep apnea is associated more so with non-REM sleep, and it usually is, but in certain cases you can see it during REM sleep, especially in the pseudo-CSA population. All right, so now we'll go on to talk about treatment, and going to discuss treatment in each of these, within each of these pathogenesis groups. And I have a question for everyone. A 68-year-old female active smoker with a medical history significant for chronic pain on opioid therapy and heart failure with ejection fraction of 40% underwent diagnostic sleep study with evidence of severe central sleep apnea. Which of the following is considered a contraindication to ASV therapy for this patient? Is it the female gender, tobacco use, opioid use, or ejection fraction of 40%? And you guys can put your answers in the chat box or just think about your answers if you want to. And the answer to this one is the ejection fraction of 40%, at least currently, based on existing data. So we had a study called the SERVE-HF trial, which came out in 2015, that basically showed that people with ejection fraction of less than or equal to 45% have increased mortality on ASV. And so we try not to use ASV in that population. So for high loop gain, there's a bunch of different treatment options: CPAP, oxygen, ASV, pharmacologic therapy, and phrenic nerve stimulation. Those are going to be the main treatments. So there is a trial called the CANPAP trial that looked at use of CPAP in patients with heart failure. And it found that when they took the group of patients in which their AHI was actually suppressed effectively, there was actually a signal for increased transplant-free survival and a better left ventricular ejection fraction, although I'm not sure that an increase of 3.6% would be clinically meaningful. But it's encouraging in that it doesn't seem to be a bad thing for patients with heart failure. So CPAP is generally accepted as a reasonable treatment option, but it doesn't always work well. So at least in this study, you know, about half of people had their AHI suppressed effectively. and the rest of them had an elevated AHI. And I would say this happens in the real world as well. Sometimes CPAP works really well and sometimes not so much. Supplemental oxygen therapy is also something that works really well, but not in all cases. There are multiple studies that date back to probably the 80s or even earlier that show reduction in the central apnea index in patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. And some of them show reductions in AHI of at least 50%, but it's not effective in all heart failure patients. I would say we use this most often in heart failure patients because in people with idiopathic central sleep apnea or some of the other types of sleep apnea, you can't get it paid for because of Medicare. You have to have a qualifying diagnosis for that. I guess in my past experience, sometimes it works really, really well and all the central apnea melts away and sometimes not. And then, as I mentioned before, for high altitude periodic breathing, this is actually the first line therapy and typically works well. So adaptive servo-ventilation, I alluded to earlier in that question, ASV is the ResMed device and AutoSV is the Respironics device. This works for obstructive and central sleep apnea. There's an EPAP, which stabilizes the airway and can treat obstructive apnea. And this can be either auto-adjusting or fixed. And then the device looks at either a 3 or a 4 minute window, depending on the brand of the device. And it changes the IPAP and the backup rate to even out the patient's ventilation. And it aims to replicate the patient's minute ventilation if it's the ResMed device, or it operates more so on peak flow if it's a Respironics device. The ASV or AutoSV is reasonable to try in primary central sleep apnea, treatment emergent central sleep apnea, people who have mixed obstructive and central sleep apnea. You can use it in opioids as long as there's no significant hypoventilation. And then there's some conflicting data for high altitude periodic breathing. I've seen some studies that say that it works and I've seen some studies that say that it doesn't. At the most recent CHEST conference that we had, we did a pro-con debate or just a discussion about some of the controversies in central sleep apnea. And we were actually very fortunate to have a sleep tech who worked at the sleep lab at the highest elevation level in the country. And so I actually asked him if they use ASV in their lab. And he says that they do and that they have success with it. So I think it's reasonable to try. This is a picture from the ResMed user manual about how it works. And so here's the patient flow. We have a nice waxing and waning breathing pattern here. And here's their minute ventilation. You can see, you know, as the breathing pattern waxes and wanes, the minute ventilation increases and decreases. So here's the point at which the ASV comes on. In this example, we have a fixed EPAP mode. So the EPAP is the same all the time, but then in the periods where the patient is taking smaller breaths or not breathing, the IPAP will increase and possibly the respiratory or the backup rate can kick in. And then when the patient is in a period of hyperpnea, that IPAP can back off, and so as not to encourage the hyperpnea. And then, you know, over time, this can even out their minute ventilation and their respiratory pattern. But as I mentioned previously, the SURF-HF trial happened in 2015, and they studied patients with heart failure and discovered that people who were in the ASV group had increased all-cause mortality. And so it's because of this study that we try not to use ASV in patients with an ejection fraction of less than or equal to 45%. Although there has been a little bit more recent research that suggests that it might be okay, but I'm going to get into that in a couple minutes. So the medications that we use are typically acetazolamide is probably the most common one. It has been shown to reduce the AHI and daytime sleepiness, and this can also be effective for high altitude periodic breathing. A lot of the time people will only have high altitude periodic breathing until they acclimate, and so it's not uncommon that I give acetazolamide to people for use, you know, for the first several days that they're at altitude. There's also data on theophylline, although I have not typically use this in clinical practice. It just has a very narrow therapeutic window, and a lot of the time you're using this in people with cardiovascular comorbidities, and so probably a potential for more side effects with the alpha-lean. But if anyone else has more experience with that, I'd be curious to hear about it. There's a couple more medications that there's a little bit of research about. So buspirone is one of them. There were a couple studies that have been done looking at very small numbers of patients. And this particular study looked at the AHI at night and during the day and found that the buspirone was effective in treating the AHI, like I said, both at night and during the day. So there are serotonergic neurons in the medulla that sense carbon dioxide and pH. And there's been some studies in animal models that show that buspirone, which is a receptor agonist, can stimulate respiration and shift the apneic threshold to a lower level of PaCO2, and that reduces the ventilatory instability. And so that's why it's thought to work. There was also another study where they looked at buspirone versus trazodone versus nothing, and found that neither buspirone nor trazodone were effective in reducing the central apnea index. That was also a very small study of, I think, 7 patients. And the reason that that might have been a different outcome than this study is because they used a lot lower dose for a shorter period of time. But, you know, this is interesting data. Again, these studies are so small that I think we need more data before we can, you know, confidently suggest this as a good treatment for central apnea. And then there's also a little bit of data, again, just very small studies, I think just with triazolam and zolpidem, looking at whether sleep consolidation is an effective means of controlling central sleep apnea. So the theory behind this is that if you can increase sleep stability and lessen the amount of arousals from sleep, that should lead to less oscillation in CO2, and with less, you know, periods of hyperpnea and oscillations of CO2, you should get less central apnea. There's also a theory that zolpidem may decrease the ventilatory responsiveness during the arousals, and so it would, you know, additionally reduce the hyperpnea and subsequent hypocapnia. In the studies that were done on zolpidem, it did not change the obstructive AHI for most patients, but actually for a few patients, it worsened the obstructive AHI. And then, of course, you know, you would probably worry about the same thing with triazolam, it being a benzodiazepine. So there's certain patient populations in which you probably would not want to use these medications, you know, if someone has untreated obstructive sleep apnea or hypoventilation. But, you know, I think appropriate to consider in some patient populations. All right, so here is a question about phrenic nerve stimulation before we get onto that topic. Which patient is an appropriate candidate for phrenic nerve stimulation for the treatment of central sleep apnea? So 55-year-old man with mixed obstructive and central apnea who is intolerant to PAP and has failed CPAP and ASV. Obstructive apnea index is 28 and central apnea index is 15. B, a 67-year-old woman with central sleep apnea due to spinal cord injury. C, 50-year-old woman with breast cancer who gets regular MRIs to monitor for recurrence and has reduced ejection fraction of 40% and an AHI of 30. Or a 45-year-old man with primary central sleep apnea with an AHI of 48. All of them are central, who is intolerant to PAP therapy. I'll give you guys just a minute to contemplate this answer. So there's actually 2 correct answers. I left this in on purpose. This question was written a while ago. It used to be that D was only the only correct answer, but now C is actually okay too, because recently the Remedy device did get approved for use with MRI. So it does have an MRI protocol. So C used to not be true, but now it's not a barrier. So the reasons that A and B are incorrect is that obstructive events must account for less than 20% of the total AHI, kind of similar to Inspire. And then it's not appropriate for central sleep apnea syndromes with hypoventilation. So it has not been studied in hypoventilation. And then obviously, you know, it works by stimulating the phrenic nerve. So if the phrenic nerve doesn't work, then it probably will not give you a good outcome. So a little bit more about the remedy device. The study that got it approval was of 151 patients, and they had central apnea of different etiologies, mostly idiopathic and heart failure, and mostly heart failure, actually, 64%. And at 6 months, 50% had an AHI, which was decreased by at least 50% compared to 11% in the control group. The adverse events were actually rather high at 9%, but most of them were minor and were able to be, you know, fixed rather easily. And then based on what we know so far, it probably does not affect mortality, might be, you know, valuable for decreasing hospitalizations and heart failure, although you really can't make that claim with the existing data. There is a signal for increased quality of life, and we have five-year data for this device, and so the treatment effects seem to be enduring for at least 5 years. This is just a picture of what it looks like. It's implanted by an EP cardiologist, and so it goes down here through the vein, and you have a stimulation lead that's in the left pericardiophrenic or right brachiocephalic vein, and that stimulates the nearby phrenic nerve. And then this is what I was talking about. So this is looking at patients with heart failure, post-hoc analysis of that subgroup. So, you know, maybe it would be helpful for hospitalizations. You know, hopefully it does not cause increased death. But like I said, this study was not designed to evaluate these outcomes. So you really can't, you know, say either of these things definitively. And then as far as the treatment is concerned, we do have the five-year data here that shows that this reduction in AHI is maintained. Most of the events left over are hypopneas, and so we're actually trying to assess these sleep studies now to find out, you know, are these obstructive hypopneas that were there before the device got implanted, or are these residual central sleep apneas that are left over just as, you know, central hypopneas that the device is not treating. So in the future, hopefully, you know, we can get a better handle on this and might help for predicting outcomes and counseling patients about what they can expect as far as the efficacy of the treatment. For failure of rhythmogenesis, ideally, if it's due to a medication, you would discontinue that medication, but, you know, a lot of the times that's not possible. And then, of course, if there's an underlying condition, you know, a tumor, Chiari malformation, a stroke, sometimes it will get better with time, sometimes not. And then other treatments for failure of rhythmogenesis are just based on presence or absence of hypoventilation in the clinical scenario. Most of the time, if a patient gets diagnosed with central sleep apnea and, you know, we're about to call it idiopathic, an MRI can be a useful thing as well to rule out any of these findings. Sometimes it's a challenge with insurance, though, because central sleep apnea is not a diagnosis that some insurances will reimburse for. So other central sleep apnea, which, as I mentioned, can be, you know, spinal cord injury, people who are hypoventilating, neuromuscular disease. Most of the time, these are actually going to require non-invasive ventilation, which can either come in the form of a pressure-targeted therapy, and mostly BiPAP ST. We use the backup rate for the basically the same benefits that were described with ASV, or VAPS, which is a volume-targeted mode. Some people have the thought, which I think makes sense, that VAPS might be a little bit better to use in this scenario. With bilevel ST, you have a fixed IPAP and a fixed EPAP. And so if the patient is having hyperapnea, the pressures are just going to be the same. And so it will, you know, could potentially encourage that hyperapnea and even lead to more central events. Whereas with VAPS, you're targeting a volume. And so if the patient is taking huge breaths, the IPAP is hopefully going to back off a bit. And we don't have any data about long-term use of these modalities in patients with central apnea. You know, some people wonder, could these cause increase in mortality too, because it's a, you know, higher IPAP and a lower EPAP and a backup rate similar to ASV. But as far as I know, we don't have a lot of data on that. You know, sometimes it might be appropriate to use a ventilator. Obviously, if you're having a patient with ALS, the gentleman that I previously mentioned ended up getting a ventilator because his respiratory situation was very impaired even during the day. And then, you know, you'll notice that ASV is not included in a treatment for people who are hypoventilating. And that's because the ASV targets the patient's own minute ventilation or peak flow. And so if they have a crappy minute ventilation, the ASV is going to create a crappy ventilation. Sometimes you can kind of make the ASV do things that it's not necessarily designed to do. You know, you can give a pressure support of the normal pressure support range is 3 to 15. In the past, if it's some sort of acute situation, or, you know, this is the machine that the patient has at home, or is trying to get them through a period where we're getting a new machine, you know, you can increase the minimum EPAP to 6 centimeters H2O and do a pressure support of 6 to 15 to hopefully provide some ventilation. But I try not to do that because that's not really what the machine is designed for. So I would say typically just avoid ASV in case of hypoventilation. So I had this nice slide about upcoming trials looking at various treatments for central sleep apnea, but unfortunately a couple of them have been discontinued. So we had the ADVENT-HF trial that was looking at the effects of ASV on survival and hospital admissions and heart failure, and then all of these secondary outcomes, mortality, new AFib, LV function, BNP, defibrillator data, 6-minute walk, heart failure stage and functional class, AHI and quality of life. So I was really, really excited for this one to come out because, you know, the thought was that our modern ASV is different than the one that they used in the SERVE-HF trial, and that maybe, you know, with the current machines that we're using, we're not going to see that increase in mortality. But they were using Respironics machines, and then the Philips recall hit, and so the trial had to be stopped, and it has not started again. There is some preliminary data, and the preliminary data that they published, one paper was about use. And the point of that paper was just to say that the use that they saw during this trial was a little bit better than some of the other trials. So the average PAP use for people with OSA was 4.6 hours, and for CSA it was 5.2 hours. Only 17% stopped using ASV, which was a lot less than during the SERVE-HF trial. And then they were not able to publish safety outcomes, which I know is kind of the thing that most people want to know about, but they did have a data safety monitoring committee looking at the safety data every 6 months, and there weren't any safety concerns. So the SERVE-HF trial, you know, was stopped because there was that signal of increased mortality. So it seems like they're not seeing that, although, like I said, the safety outcomes are not available. The other study that I was really excited for is this impact of low flow nocturnal oxygen therapy on hospital admissions and mortality in patients with heart failure and central sleep apnea. So as I mentioned before, we have some data to suggest that oxygen is effective in reducing the AHI, but it would be really helpful to know, you know, morbidity, mortality, hospital admission, you know, heart function, you know, does oxygen impact any of these? And so they were going to look at some of these outcomes measures, but it was terminated early due to low feasibility of completion within the study period because they had slow participant accrual. So I don't know what is to become of that study. There's not a whole lot of other studies going on with oxygen and central sleep apnea, according to clinicaltrials.gov, but I really wish we had gotten some information from that study. And then there's the REST study, which is a prospective cohort study evaluating some more outcomes from people who are implanted with the Remedy phrenic nerve stimulator. So And this is just kind of getting going, but they're going to enroll up to 500 patients from multiple institutions. And so hopefully that will give us a little bit more long-term data on the efficacy and safety of the remedy system. And that's all I have. So if anyone has any questions or discussion or comments, I would love to hear it.
Yeah, and just be sure to unmute so that you'll be heard.
Sarah?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's Lisa Wolf.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to throw something out there for you. I know that this is not something that people usually look at. Your question on the phrenic nerve stimulation.
Yeah.
Was very remedy focused. If you look at the other two phrenic nerve stimulation devices on the market, the Avery pacemaker and the Synapse pacemaker, those actually are directly tested for hypoventilation and approved for hypoventilation.
Okay.
And those are the devices we use for things like spinal cord injury and central congenital hypoventilation syndrome. Obviously, for the people who are on here that are just looking at more traditional central sleep apnea, they probably never heard of those two, but I just wanted to throw it out there.
Yes, thank you. As I mentioned, I have a bias. those devices are not for central sleep apnea though, correct? Or they're just for
Look, these are for people. So let's say that you have CCHS. Mm-hmm. CCHS is central hypoventilation. Mm-hmm. So to the degree that that's a form of central sleep apnea, mm-hmm. Yes. And in spinal cord injury, same thing. Like you said, they're like pseudo-central, right? Because
yes.
Nothing, but they have a backup rate. And that backup rate on both of those devices is there to treat the central apnea. So, you know, the question is, would you ever use an Avery for somebody who had normal muscle function or normal brain function? I haven't done that. I've only done it, like I said, for spinal cord injury and CCHS.
Okay. I'm going to include that. That's a good point. Thank you for pointing that out. Obviously, I don't know as much about those.
Yeah, that's called a day in Wolf Clinic.
And it looks like Allie posted that there are some sleep medicine fellows from Northwestern who have presented a case at the Illinois Sleep Society I'm going to butcher this name.
Ticagrelor.
Yes, induced CSA. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we learned from them. I actually didn't know that until that summer, so that was fun. It's fun to hear it here. And you know, just one common question, and just to kind of see what the group is doing, but I've had quite a few patients where they have, let's say it's opioid, most of them are opioid related, and they have a pretty significant combination of obstructive and centrals and actually hypoventilation that I've put on VAPS devices. But I have to say the IVAPS with the intelligent backup rate is a pain because the backup rate tries to like stay out of the way, which like, then what I tend to see is this high residual central. So I've been then switching them to the pressure support ventilation with the target safety volume, which is essentially
all you have to do is add 3. So like if you're using the intention IBR instead of the regular.
Yeah.
So like if normally you would put 12, make it 15. If you normally would do 15, do it 18. All you have to do is add 3 and it essentially turns off your IBR.
It turns it off?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Because it's targeting a higher backup rate. What do you think of the other mode that is the pressure support ventilation with the targets, like the safety final volume? Because it's essentially like AVAPs in it.
If you're... I'm so sorry. Kara, do you want to answer?
No, please. I'm learning also. So no, go ahead.
The problem is going to be that your initial pressure support minimum If you're going to do something that is not volume targeted, but volume safety, it's going to have to be a lot higher. So otherwise, it's going to take too long to get to the target. So as long as your pressure support minimum is set higher, closer to where you think you're going to need to be, you can safety target and you're fine. Otherwise, you're better off looking at volume targeting and then just upping your baseline respiratory rate.
And I don't mean to go crazy here, but the intelligent backup rate, then doesn't it like increases the backup rate to 18 at some point and then goes back down? It kind of goes up and down.
Well, I mean, the reality is, when the intelligent backup rate is there, it waits for the patient's endogenous rate to go down and then it kicks in. But that can be uncomfortable for patients. So by giving them the extra 3, it will kick in as necessary. And then you don't have to have that problem.
Okay. I'll try it. Have you worked with any of this?
Using VAPS for central sleep apnea? Yeah, I think that especially IVAPS sometimes has unpredictable results. But a lot of times when I'm doing when I'm initiating IVAPS, we're on the hospital sleep medicine service. And so, you know, typically there's a lot more opportunities to just, you know, play with their settings and alter, you know, increase the backup rate if needed. And so I'm not sure that I could describe it as eloquently as Lisa does, but yes, increasing the backup rate is a good thing.
Yeah, the only time that intelligent backup rate is helpful is in COPD, because it allows them to fall asleep without the intrusion of extra events. Yeah. But if you're in neuromuscular, it's the opposite, because the patient can't fall asleep without that support. And so that's why, you know, increasing that backup rate takes over for that problem. But it's one of the big differences between COPD and neuromuscular. And then, Kara, can I just throw one other thing out there?
Yeah.
The discussion that you had about drugs, I love, because you put baclofen in there.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to remind people that the biggest offense with baclofen is baclofen pumps. And frequently, pumps don't get added to our med list because the patient doesn't have to take it daily, right? It's just there and pumping. So reminding people to ask specifically about pumps.
Yeah, I've seen several cases of central sleep apnea, which were at least in part due to a baclofen pump. I had a patient who had a morphine and a baclofen pump who had very bad central sleep apnea.
Baby, if you wanted them to never breathe again, that's how you'd do it.
Yeah, I had a patient too, which I was really curious about. This was recently, so I haven't really mentioned it to a lot of people, but he was on tizanidine and came into the sleep lab, you know, for obstructive apnea. And then, you know, he was on there on his iPad awake and was having just, you know, periodic breathing during the day. And then, of course, he went to sleep and he did still have obstruction, but, you know, there's definitely a central component. And then the next time that he came in, he had stopped the tizanidine because I could not figure out why he would have central apnea during the day. And I just was like, will you do this experiment for me? And he said, I don't think the tizanidine is doing anything anyway. And he came back and he still had central apnea when he was sleeping, but it was gone when he was awake. So I just found that very interesting.
Yeah, it's the GABA function of the tizanidine that's doing it. And in the animal models, they take the little microdialysis pipettes and just put the GABA blocker onto the brainstem, and you can get horrible centrals. If it's bad enough with a pump, they're actually apneustic with breath holds rather than at exhalation. And that can make it super hard to treat, because if it's with breath hold, what do you do with the PAP, right? Like, somebody would have to sit there and squeeze their chest rather than give them an IV.
Does anyone else have any fun stories or any other questions?
Okay, I just have one other fun story.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever heard of a FODMAP diet?
Yes.
So one of the things about the FODMAP diet, they use it a lot for like irritable bowel and that kind of thing. They change you so that you get all of these foods that eventually induce alkalosis. And the alkalosis apparently helps the bowel, but what it does is it closes the CO2 gap so that when you look at their ability to handle loop gain, it's significantly impaired. So we have a guy who's gone on and off FODMAP, and when he's on it, he gets centrals, and then when he's off it, it goes away.
That is super interesting. My mom is on a FODMAP diet. But no, I hadn't heard that before, and I actually didn't even realize that it was meant. Is it designed to induce alkalosis, or is that just like a?
It may just be part of the side effect of it.
It sounds like a horrible diet. I won't be doing that.
Yeah. It makes them very gassy too.
Not fun. But that's super interesting. I'm gonna have to look that up. I just saw Sheree's comment.
Yes.
All right. Anything else?
Okay. If there's no other questions, thanks everybody for joining us today. This is awesome. I'm glad that we are getting more section content out there. So thank you, Kyle, for being our guinea pig on our first sleep webinar. More to come. We will be editing this. I will drop it in to our communications team. And we'll post it on our Sleep Network page so that we can share it out to everyone else. But thank you all for joining us today. If you have any other questions, you can reply to the email that invited you, and we can get those over. So if Kara has any answers for you afterwards, we can get those out as well.
All right. Thank you so much, everybody. I'm really honored that I got to do the inaugural lecture. So thanks a lot for having me.